The following contains a poem with language that may not be appropriate for listeners of all ages.
Poetry is a way of articulating experiences, human experiences that often are inarticulable.
Poetry makes us listen. Poetry makes us engage with one another in a way that today's world seldom allows for. I'm Ilan Stavans, and this is the In Contrast podcast. My guest is Wendy Barker, poet in residence and the Pearl Lewin Professor of Creative Writing at the University of Texas in San Antonio. Wendy Barker is the author of 6 collections of poetry, her latest being One Blackbird in Time. She has also written scholarly works on Emily Dickinson and translated the poetry of Rabindranath Tagore. It is a pleasure, Wendy Barker, to have you in Contrast. Let me begin by asking you, to what extent do you think that poetry is important today in this democracy that we have that sometimes feels so belligerent and so explosive? What made you become a poet, and what role do people like you play today?
Well, first of all, Ilan, thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here. I'm honored. And oh my, those are big questions. And the first one, or two questions, right? The first one about what role poetry plays in our troubled world. It seems on the surface to play a very minor role. The novel used to be the big thing, and movies are the big thing, and poets, who are poets? What is poetry? Poetry books don't sell the way novels do, or how-to books sell. And yet, I think poetry is essential. Poetry slows us down. Poetry is a way of articulating experiences, human experiences that often are inarticulable. Things that are very hard to say in ordinary prose. Experiences that come from the gut, from the groin, bypass our quick, not just intellectual responses, but our quick, the kind of responses that you were talking about, and especially now, since November, the vitriol that we see exploding all over the country is dangerous. And poetry is a way of moving us into those experiences that we all share as human beings and yet are often very difficult to express in our day-to-day language that has become more and more shorthand, less and less dealing with nuance. Also, I think with poetry, the sounds are so important. So the sounds take us to a place that we inhabit, as I said, in the gut or further down.
Did you always know you wanted to be a poet?
No, I didn't always know. But I adored poetry. I was a very lucky kid in that my parents both loved poetry and both loved to read and both loved to recite poetry. It was one of the few things they had in common, actually. But they would read to me when I was really little. And so I grew up on A.A. Milne and other poets, too. And I always adored poetry. I was kind of a closet poet, I think, for most of my life. I always wrote. I always kept journals from the time I learned to write. I always kept journals. And I was trying to write short stories as a teenager, but it took me a long time. I was in my 20s and teaching ninth graders before I began to realize it was poetry I was trying to write. And then went to graduate school and sort of came out of the closet, if you will, and took some little baby poems to Sandra Gilbert at UC Davis. And she was wonderful, very encouraging, and I got into graduate workshops. And I came out of the closet in my really early 30s.
The experience that I have read connected with your upbringing is that you moved often when you were young, and that the reading of poetry and that the engagement with different types of poets and of poems gave you a sense of place. Tell me about being an itinerant young person. What did it mean to be moving from school to school, from town to town?
Oh, boy. There's a book there. I mean, that's a big question, Ilan, and an important one. And I may only be beginning to realize what it meant. What it meant was that I never quite belonged anywhere. And books were my salvation. I learned quickly to fit in as best I could, but books really were a kind of salvation. And I think that as I grew older, even in my high school teaching years, in my 20s, I found that literature, and particularly poetry, would be a way to connect with students and so help them come to themselves, and helped me to find who I was rather than what I learned to do, which was to try to fit in everywhere but maybe wasn't being me, so that poetry became a way of being me, of expressing who I really was and all these different selves. We all have different selves. I mean, even those of us who don't come from other countries and learn other languages. I learned other dialects within the United States because of the moving around so much. So I think poetry was a way of expressing differences, expressing essences, and also of trying to connect with others. I love hearing others. I care very much about the students and their writings and their reaching out through their writings. So I love that sense of being able to connect through language.
The two roles, or the two selves, as you are describing, the poet self and the teacher self, they need each other, they are in dialogue. And as one reads through your work, one sees that becoming a teacher, engaging students, becoming part of a community of students, is something that is not only an activity that you do on a regular basis, but it is filtered into your poetry itself. I know that you have a poem that is connected with Langston Hughes and how you teach different poets. So I'd love to hear you read that poem, and then I want to ask you about your relationship with students through poetry.
Here's the poem then, Elon, Langston Hughes' Weary Blues. And I'm talking about that particular poem, Weary Blues, and I also mentioned another poem of his called Suicide's Note in this poem. And this is a sort of poem where the title bleeds into the first line. Langston Hughes' Weary Blues. Langston Hughes' Weary Blues needs no explaining in this class. No one needs a gloss on Suicide's Note. That river so calm, asking a kiss. Yet none of us around this table has ever been kept out of a KFC or a multiplex because of our skin. Nobody knows the trouble I've seen, sang Lena Horne, who couldn't stay at the Savoy Plaza after she'd made the crowd swing. Enough trouble right here in this room. Anne's just driven from the hospice, her gay dad's body shriveling into the sheets, her mother and brothers refusing to visit. Last week, Robert's cousins were found mangled by the train tracks in Sabinas for the Los Zetas dope they were running, only way to pay for beans and rice. This morning in my office, Christina soaked through the 6 tissues I offered as she told how the fucked-up ex-Marine raped her in the ass over and over, his loaded .45 beside the pillow. No wonder Hughes, pianist, stopped playing and went to bed, where he slept like a rock or a man that's dead. I need to focus on the poem, call and response, structure of the blues. Nathan might help. He's a musician. But already he's talking. Hey, after class, how many of y'all want to drive over to JJ's? Awesome piano, sax, bass. And all I say is, count me in.
The poem includes all these voices and all these challenges the students that you as a teacher have on a regular basis bring onto you. We, of course, as teachers, are more than simply the facilitators. We become figures that students use sometimes to confess some terrible problem that they are going through, or mentors or parents' figures. And here, the poem, you pay tribute to those different voices, and you also want to see the world from the viewpoint of a poet like Langston Hughes, who, being African-American, is not allowed to be a full member of the society. Do poems start for you, end for you, live for you in the classroom?
Many do. And certainly, Elon, as you know, the poems from my most recent collection, One Blackbird at a Time, those poems really do come out of the classroom. They all deal with experiences in the classroom. I guess I've been teaching over 50 years, which is sort of scary to think about. But I guess one of the things that annoys me is when people assume that teaching at a university, you're living in an ivory tower, that there's this sort of just intellectual life divorced from, quote, real life. Hardly. I mean, the students come to us, and of course, teaching in South Central Texas, many of our students are first-generation college students. These students have difficulties. And teaching university, we deal with students with real problems. But to answer your question, yes, many of the poems have sprung, and all the poems in this new collection have sprung from experiences in the classroom.
Because we live in the age of fake news, fake realities, I wonder what you would say is truth in poetry.
Oh, my. I'm sure there are all kinds of people I could quote who I can't think of right now. What is truth in poetry? There's a poem that kind of deals with that in One Blackbird at a Time called Truth, Beauty, and the, I think, Intro Creative Writing Workshop. In poetry, and I guess from dealings with other people, the kind of truth I care most about is the internal truth, the truth of a life, the truth from the life. A truth is that I can't put my hands through this table. This table is what we call solid. That's true. And how it feels to my fingers. It feels smooth and hard. And that's truth. And I think that one thing that we need from literature more than ever is a way to get at what truths we do have and to express those. That's a hard question you asked.
You are also a translator. You have worked with a colleague of yours in bringing into English the Bengali poetry of India's Nobel Prize-winning poet Rabindranath Tagore. When I read about how you translate, I was even more fascinated. You don't speak more than two or three words of Bengali. Traditionally, one gets the sense that in order to translate a poet from one language to another, one needs to have access to that language. Walk me through the process of bringing into English the later work of Tagore, and how challenging was it for you as a poet?
Ilan, it was one of the most wonderful experiences of my life. It was exhilarating and reviving. I grew enormously through my work with what I would call a three-way mind meld among the poet Rabindranath, his great-grandnephew Sarinendranath Tagore, who went by the name Bapa. Bapa and I would meet regularly every week and in my study, and Bapa would make himself comfortable and read one of Tagore's poems out loud. I would ask him to read each poem over and over because what I wanted to do was let those sounds wash through me so I had a sense of the music of the poem. The music of Bengali is totally different from the sound effects of English. One of the very few words I do know in Bengali is bashahinata, which means silence. And that's for some reason that word keeps coming into my head right now. But Bapa would read, and I would get a sense of the sounds, of the rhythms. And then I would go to the computer, and he would just talk me through word by word by word in the syntactical order of the Bengali, which is very different from our noun, verb, object syntactical order in English. And I would write at the computer possible translations. Sometimes he'd have like six possibilities for a word. After that, we might go through and kind of see what we would think would work best. And then he would leave. And then I would go through and come up with various versions. And one of the things we were trying to do was we wanted to make the poems work as effective contemporary American poems. By contemporary American standards, they would work as good poems. But we also wanted to keep as much as we could of the flavor of the Bengali. So sometimes we would keep the Bengali syntactical order, even though it might seem a little odd in English, because we wanted to keep the flavor. So it would be a line by line, word by word, back and forth, many, many drafts, a kind of decision-making process.
How long would a poem take to be translated? In these many drafts, would this take place during several weeks?
Yeah.
Even months?
Yeah, or even more. Yeah. It depends on the poem.
And when do you consider both that a translation that you are doing is finished and that a poem of yours has reached the version that you are happy to show the public?
Well, the quick answer would be to quote Yeats, the great poet Yeats, who said, "A poem is never finished, only abandoned." And I would echo that for my work. But my process involves a number of other people. I am very lucky to have several other poet friends who love exchanging poems. And I call it poeming. And we exchange poems, we exchange drafts, we comment, we make suggestions, we go back and forth, and we go back and forth. Without those friends and my brilliant husband, Steve Kelman, my poems would be awful. I'm very, very grateful to have that group of friends who I'm lucky I get to see their poems and comment on theirs, and they make suggestions for mine.
And do you take all those suggestions?
Not always. I'd say 90% of the time, yes. But sometimes a suggestion will point to a place around that place. I mean, maybe somebody says, "You need a transition here. This is too big a jump." That might not be exactly what I'll do, but I'll do something around that place or it'll point to something that needs fiddling with. I say 90% of the time I will, and I think 90% of the time my friends will take my suggestions, I think. So, yeah. So
one of the impressions I get when reading your poetry is that you want both to bring the music that connects with a particular experience, the rhythm, and the sensibility. But also you are into the spiritual aspect of words. Not the religious, but the spiritual. So I wonder if you grew up religious, if you have had a relationship with larger forces, God maybe, that you can tell us so that some of us who read your poetry will be enlightened.
That's a very, very difficult question, and it's a profound one. I did not grow up in a religious household. My father worked at an office long hours and treasured his time alone at home, able to read, often poetry. He thought that church was a place for people to show off their clothes, and he didn't want any part of it. He was kind of an Emersonian. My mother from England had been brought up in the Church of England, although I don't think very strictly. I think occasionally they went to church. But she took us, her three daughters, to an Episcopal church. Here and there, she would take us to an Episcopal church wherever we were living, so that I did learn the Lord's Prayer and the Nicene Creed, and I sort of learned how to behave and what to do. I think I was 9 or 10 when I read through the whole King James Bible, and I was moved by some parts. This is very hard to talk about because, in some ways, talking about spirituality is going beyond words. My sense of spirituality came from profound experiences with what we loosely call the natural world. There was time sometimes in the summers in New Hampshire at Squam Lake. I know that that water, that lake, those pines really were imprinted on me in a way. If somebody asks me, I will say, I'm not religious, but I do think of myself as a spiritually connected person. I do try to inhabit a space that goes beyond the space that connects us, that surrounds us, that connects us, that's within us, that's beyond the kind of words that you were talking about at the very beginning of this interview, these hateful words. I've been very influenced by Buddhism. I'm not a practicing Buddhist, but I've been very influenced by Buddhist teachings, I suppose. We're all connected. It's all connected. And it's just not human beings that are connected. We're connected. The trees talk to each other. We're just learning that the trees' roots have ways of communicating to each other in ways that we're only beginning to understand. It's all a matter of interconnectedness. So I don't know if that answers you or not.
Yes, certainly does. And your more recent poetry is very devoted to understanding the environment, your connection with the environment, with trees in particular. Mm-hmm. Trees seem to have an important role in your life and in the neck of the woods. Maybe that's the wrong impression, the wrong expression for the part where you're in, because you talk in this poem about the disappearing trees, the fact that their company is no more. You see poetry and that environmental aspect as a feature of your later work.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yes. Yes. Moving more and more in that direction. Yes.
You have a beautiful poem that deals with God in the way you look at it. I think it's called If a God, and I would love for you to read it.
This is one of my husband's favorite poems because, in a way, it is a love poem to him. I wrote it while we were traveling in India. It does have to do with connectedness, doesn't it? It does. If a God. If a God comes to you, a small fish in the night, simply become water. If a dove drifts under your sheets, let him stay. Tuck his head in a soft place. Rest until you are feathers. He may come as a lizard, a slip of a green slither across your wall, crevices left from past freezes and thaws as he turns translucent, persimmon, ablaze. Or a monkey who leaps your crenellations, weightless motion of silver brown fur, uncurling tail, and keen eyes focused in, beyond. When a god comes to you as a man, you will have no need for questions, blossoms, or bracelets, even a name.
You are listening to In Contrast from New England Public Radio. I'm Ilan Stavans, and my guest is poet Wendy Barker. There's a kind of paradigm here that I am puzzled and fascinated by, and that is that almost at the core of your enterprise as a poet is to reach, I gather, from the very eloquent ways in which you describe your journey and the gorgeous poetry that you produce, a kind of desire for silence, for giving silence. That is the word, in fact, that you know in Bengali. Maybe silence is the end of poetry, because if there is silence, there's no poetry. But maybe silence is the end of poetry in terms of goal, because it allows us to hear in between words the beauty and the eloquence of non-words. So can you talk a bit about your relationship with silence?
Oh my goodness, Ilan. That is just incredibly insightful, and I'm quite moved and almost, I'm speechless. I'm silent in response to your question. Yes, Bashahinata. Isn't that strange that I keep thinking of that? Maybe this has to do with aging, too. Golly, silence, yes. The words under the words, and a sense of stopping, of sort of stopping all this crazy pace that we live in. I mean, even I'm checking my iPhone. We really live at a frenetic pace, so utterly different from the great poet Emily Dickinson, whose work is just infused with silences, those dashes, those pauses, the sense in her writing of the words beyond, behind, under the words, and the silences between. Because ultimately, we can't express everything in words, can we? I mean, we just can't. And yet, we want to try. So there's that strange, almost at times seemingly futile effort of trying to express the inexpressible, which I guess is what I love about poetry, is that it's trying to express what really can't be uttered in words, but yet we want to.
Let me conclude by asking you, with poetry at the bottom of the pecking order, besieged, often eliminated from federal and state and local programs because it doesn't produce, it doesn't bring in numbers. What do you do to pass on to the next generation as a teacher and as a poet, the love and the commitment that a writer must have in order to go on writing the beautiful poems that you write, in spite of the fact that the world seems to be going like a train without any train station nearby?
It's a big question. In the first poem, In One Blackbird at a Time, I talk about someone who came to the house to fix my computer, and he walked in, and my husband Steve and I are both writers. We have at least 12,000 books, and he went, "Oh, look at all these books. Oh, he asked if I wrote, and I said, "Yes, I write." "What do you write?" And I said, "Well, poetry." And he literally said, "Oh, fluffy stuff." I mean, he said, "I've got it. I've got him in the poem." But that often is the reaction. So what do I do to counteract that? I still adore the teaching. I do adore the teaching. And what I tell the students is that your voices matter. We need everyone's voice speaking from their authentic selves, their authentic experiences. And I teach poetry. I don't teach fiction anymore. But I care about poetry that reaches people deep down, that touches a core of the humanness of us all. So with students, I work with them on trying to express what's real for them. Often they will try to write superficial poems, and I will, not in a critical way, but try to encourage them, you know, wait a minute, this word seems pretty loaded here. What was it that that mother said to the speaker here? I don't say your mother. So I think just encouraging people to, in a way, be honest. Yes, poetry can lie, but it can't lie in terms of the truth of actual experiences, even painful experiences, especially painful experiences, or ecstatic. How else do we express ecstasy or rapture or real agony? Well, there are other ways. Obviously, music and other ways, and fiction can do it too. Music and painting, of course, sculpture. But poetry is one wonderful way to express these deep down experiences and feelings that otherwise our culture doesn't want. We want this phony cheer. We want vitriol or phony cheer. And we can't live that way. That's not a way to keep a sustained life going. I think poetry keeps us going.
It has been a privilege and an honor to bring not only your words, but your silences into this program. This is In Contrast. I am Ilan Stavans. You're listening to New England Public Radio. My guest has been, lucky for us, Wendy Barker. Thank you for coming.
Thank you so much, Ilan. What a pleasure.
Poems always come last, a friend of mine likes to say, because other things apparently are more important. This is true, but this last place that poems have often matters in peculiar ways. Poets spend their days and nights crafting verbal houses as if the world depended on them. They work and rework a single word. They recalibrate a comma with the precision of a watchmaker, and they laboriously look for the music of sounds. What they come up with looks fragile, yet pay attention to it and you'll realize the DNA of humankind is in it. Can a poem stop a tank? Can it put a corrupt leader in jail? Can it bring out the truth when efforts are made to hide it? The answer to all these questions is a resounding yes. It might not look like it, but a poem is enormously powerful. For one thing, it has the capacity, when it is really good, to last. And people love things that last. When a poem lasts, it speaks to readers of different times and places. It manages to go beyond its immediate origins to become universal. When a poem does its job, it moves people to the core. It makes them look at things anew. It inspires them to action. A poem is made of words and paper and sound, but it can change everything. That's a lot to say of an artifact that always comes last. Let us know what you think about In Contrast. Review us on Apple Podcasts or send an email to radio@nepr.net. You can also find information about all of NEPR's podcasts at nepr.net or on Apple Podcasts. On the next In Contrast, Norton Jester, author of The Phantom Tollbooth.
My father was, I considered, a very funny man, but he wasn't funny in a big ha-ha kind of way. He was funny on little things that he would say that maybe half an hour later you'd realize that he'd been talking nonsense. I would walk into the house maybe at 3 o'clock around when I got back from school. He'd be sitting reading the paper in the living room, and he'd look up and he'd say, "Ah, I see you're coming early since lately. You used to be behind before, but now you're first at last." I had no idea what he was talking about. He would sense that immediately. He'd get up, he'd walk over, pat me on the shoulder and then on the head, and say, "Well, you're a good kid, and I'd like to see you get ahead. You need one."
That's next time on In Contrast. The executive producer is John Vosey. I'm Ilan Stavans. Thanks for listening. In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio.